Chapter 82, Shameful Betrayal, the St. Bartholomew Night. A social bustle prevails in Paris. From entire France, thousands and yet thousands of French people, young and old, have traveled to Paris, the capital of the nation. Roman Catholics and Huguenots have set out to celebrate a reconciliatory wedding. A reconciliatory wedding? What is that now again? What do they mean with that? We shall try to make it clear. As we already told you in the previous chapter, in 1570, the bloody Huguenot War in France came to a sudden end with the Peace of Saint Germain. All the shedding of blood of citizens of the same country was unexpectedly stopped. France could recover itself of the heavy blows which the country had received. Peace between Roman Catholics and Huguenots. From now on, they would live peacefully next to each other. They would no longer harm each other in all sorts of ways. Freedom of religion for everyone. They would learn to tolerate each other. Only in Paris and some other large cities, the unrestricted divine services were not granted to the Huguenots. Gaspard de Coligny, the principal director of the Huguenots, came daily as friend to the royal court. It seemed as if Catherine de Medici and the king were serious about the reconciliation. Now an end should come for good to that mutual hatred and envy. Thus spake the king and his mother. To perpetuate the reconciliation even more, Catherine de Medici gave her consent to a reconciliatory wedding. Henry of Navarre, one of the leaders of the Huguenots, would enter into marriage with Margaret, the daughter of Catherine de Medici, and thus the sister of King Charles IX. Indeed, it could not be better. Everywhere preparatory measures were taken. The most prominent Roman Catholics, but naturally also the most prominent Huguenots, were invited to take part in that illustrious feast. The rumors of the reconciliation between the Roman Catholics and Huguenots penetrated even into foreign countries. In Rome resides Pope Pius V, the powerful ecclesiastical prince of the Roman Catholic Church. He likewise hears what shall take place in France. An expression of dissatisfaction, but also of amazement, glides over his face. "What is that now?" he mumbles. "Are they closing a friendship with those wicked heretics in France? I am disappointed in them." He wants to know more about that, and if possible, prevent that plan. As soon as possible, an ambassador of the Pope, even a cardinal, travels to Paris. He requests an interview with the King of France. He is received very kindly by the royal court, but he is rather stern and reserved. He tells the royal family that the Pope is very much dissatisfied and with great uneasiness observes the developments in France. He would very much like to receive some clarification so that he can give an answer to his master. A short time later, he leaves the royal palace again. A smile plays about his lips, and every now and then he nods approvingly. But the calmly walking and shopping Huguenots in Paris do not see that. As fast as possible, the papal ambassador travels back to Rome and brings a report to Pius V of that which he has heard and seen in France, especially of that which he has heard. Also, the Pope smiles shrewdly, and he does not send a second ambassador. It seems as if that cardinal has received a favorable answer, because it appears from everything that they are well satisfied. Thus it is, too. The royal family has assured him it would all lead to the welfare of the Roman Catholic Church. The Pope need not make himself uneasy about it. It shall all turn out for the best. In the meantime, everything is being put in order for that royal marriage. From far and near, the most prominent Huguenots come to Paris, especially many nobles. Various ones bring their wives and children with them. That is sociable. During the day, those little ones play and romp with their Roman Catholic neighboring boys and girls. And why not? That is just right. It belongs that way, does it not? The mother of Henry Navarre, the God-fearing Jeanne d'Albret, likewise travels to Paris to become acquainted with her prospective daughter-in-law and the other members of the royal family. She is cordially received by Catherine de Medici and the king. Both exhaust themselves to make it as pleasant as possible for her. Yet Jeanne d'Albret is not happy with the proposed marriage of her son. With indignation and fright, she beholds the wicked life at the royal court. Must her son henceforth live in and associate with those surroundings? She shudders when she thinks about that. Shall not her child be dragged along with that wickedness? She fears that Henry shall begin to feel himself at home there, and perhaps shall go along with them. Oh, the soul's welfare of her son is worth more to her than all the riches and the splendor of the royal court. It is to be easily understood that she is very reserved and does not cordially acknowledge the kindness of Catherine de Medici. She does not notice the false, somewhat mocking glance which Catherine now and then casts at her. During those days of preparation, the king and de Coligny come together daily. The young king comes entirely under the influence of the calm, dignified Gaspard de Coligny. Serious conversations are often carried on between these two. Finally, the king gets to love the noble, sincere de Coligny because, and Charles IX realizes that, de Coligny means what he says and he desires the best for him. De Coligny seeks the welfare of France and of the royal family. This sincerity attracts Charles IX. At times they discuss with each other the state of affairs in France and devise plans whereby France's prosperity shall rise. Then again they discuss the serious condition in the Netherlands, where a handful of Dutchmen have joined in a desperate struggle against the powerful world empire of Spain. Could we not assist and support those brave Dutchmen? Asks de Coligny, and the king nods his assent. Finally, it gets so far that the French monarch approves of the plan to hasten with an army of Huguenots to the assistance of the oppressed Dutchmen. The plans take on a more definite form. France and the Netherlands together shall attack Spain. They have already contacted William of Orange, who has the leadership of the war in the Netherlands. When de Coligny leaves the palace of the king, Catherine de Medici watches him from one of the many windows. Her eyes flash fire and flicker with hatred and rage. Even her face is distorted by the hatred which stirs and seethes within her. But de Coligny, who quietly and meditatively continues his walk, does not see that. Neither does Gaspard de Coligny know that at times the queen has secret conversations with the powerful Roman Catholic dukes, Charles and Henry de Guy. They were the leaders of the Roman Catholic Party, were they not? Henry de Guy was the son of Francis de Guy, about whom we told you in the previous chapter, who had the massacre of the Huguenots at Vassy upon his conscience. Gaspard de Coligny was not invited to all those conferences and communications. No, he was not permitted to be present there. The date of the wedding approaches quickly. On August 18, 1572, it shall be solemnized. Everything seems to be in perfect order. But then Jeanne d'Albret, the God-fearing mother of Henry Navarre, the future bridegroom, dies suddenly. Say, that gives room for thought. The Huguenots frightened from that. How did that happen now all at once? Was this death caused purposely? Some of the Huguenots no longer trust it. All sorts of rumors are going around. It is being told that Catherine de Medici has presented Jeanne d'Albret with a pair of beautiful gloves. And, thus it is whispered, those gloves were heavily poisoned within. Thus, Jeanne d'Albret would have been murdered in a crafty way. Alarm fills the hearts of many. What is true about those rumors? But when competent doctors examine the corpse of Jeanne d'Albret, then according to their report, they find no trace of poison. They do find an ugly, malignant growth in one of the lungs of the deceased. Then the uneasiness subsides with the Huguenots. Thus, Jeanne d'Albret died a natural death. Whether that is really true, we do not know. God alone can give a correct answer to that. One thing we dare to say, Catherine de Medici would have been well capable of doing that, and when we consider the end and the result of this history, then we put a large question mark behind the report of those doctors. However it may be, the Huguenots remain in Paris. On the 18th of August, 1572, the marriage is solemnized. For 3 days they joyfully celebrate in Paris. And that occasion is worthy of that, isn't that so? On the 22nd of August, Gaspard de Coligny walks calmly to his hotel. He has just been to the king and has again discussed plans with him to assist the Dutch. Suddenly, a shot rings out. De Coligny is wounded in his left shoulder. The index finger of his right hand is also shot off. Due to this cowardly attempted murder, another wave of emotion runs through the Huguenots. Now many do not trust it at all anymore. This is the second time that they are shaken in their confidence. Some hastily pack their trunks and depart as soon as possible. But yea, how does that go in such cases? The one looks at the other. They talk, they loiter. However, most of the Huguenots remain in Paris because they learn that the king himself has visited de Coligny in his hotel. He speaks very kindly and is filled with sympathy for the wounded leader of the Huguenots. "You have the wound, but I have the sorrow," thus speaks Charles IX. He promises that the murderer shall be severely punished. Perhaps Charles IX has also meant those words because he had come entirely under the influence of de Coligny. Yet in spite of all those investigations, the murderer is not found. No, of course he is not, because he was hired by Catherine de Medici to remove Coligny out of the way. But the king did not know that. Catherine had not told him that. It is the night of 23rd to 24th of August, 1572. It has become quiet in Paris. Most of the residents have gone to bed, to sleep. Only in the royal palace they are still celebrating merrily. Many nobles, among whom are also various nobles of the Huguenots, do not think about going to sleep. But outside of that, it has become quiet in France's capital. It is a nice, quiet summer night in August, but that pleasant calm is only a pretense. The midnight hour is long past. Suddenly, a pistol shot cracks. And then a hellish uproar breaks out. Suddenly, it swarms with people in the street. They have a white band around the arm and a white cross on their hat. That is an identification mark. The streets are full of uproar. We hear the cracking of doors that are kicked in. We hear the terrific screams of women, the shouts of men in mortal fear. We hear the moaning of the wounded. Shots are fired everywhere. What does all this mean? Oh, the massacre of the Huguenots commences. What? The massacre of the Huguenots? And the Roman Catholics and the Huguenots have just been reconciled to each other. From now on, peace would prevail in France, would it not? They have just celebrated a reconciliatory wedding. Ah, all that was only pretense. All that was base, vile deceit. Catherine de Medici and her servants have set up the most base trap for the Huguenots, which has ever occurred in history. All that would-be friendliness was hypocrisy, base deceit. It had already been her plan from the beginning. For that reason, the papal ambassador about whom we told you in the beginning of this chapter went back to Rome smiling. Through that friendliness, the Huguenots have been lured into the trap. The most prominent Huguenots had come to Paris to be slaughtered like sheep. In this terrible night, this night of blood, murder races through the streets of Paris. By hundreds, by thousands, the poor, startled Huguenots are killed, slaughtered as animals. Their cries of distress rend the quietness of the summer night. Men, women, even children are cut down without compassion. Gray-haired ones are cruelly murdered without pity. Some try to flee in that terrible confusion. However, their attempts to do that fail because the Roman Catholics have also taken measures against this. Everywhere they have stretched chains over the streets to make escape almost impossible. While fleeing in mortal fear, the Huguenots stumble and are killed. Indescribable scenes are enacted. They are really too dreadful to relate. Yet we will write something about it because this event may not be forgotten. Not because they are so nice, but as a sharp accusation against Rome, who has approved and applauded this massacre. No, it is not our intention to sow hatred against the Roman Catholic people. But the other way around, everything may not be hushed up either. This has happened, and may not be forgotten. God does not forget either. Children who a few hours ago had been playing with each other, now in the middle of the night tried to murder each other. Some Roman Catholic children strangled their playmates of the day before without actually realizing what they were doing. They are urged on by the grown-up people. The corpses are cast by the hundreds into the Shine River, which is colored red with the blood. Behold, there comes a fellow with a child of about 2 years old upon his arm out of a house of which the door has been kicked in. The youngster smiles friendly at him. The child puts its little hands in the hair of his beard and plays with it. And then that brute takes his knife, stabs that sharp steel into the body of that innocent child, and after that laughingly cast that youngster into the river. While grinning, that murderer goes away and looks for a new little victim. It seems as if all human feeling in him has vanished. For such a thing there are no longer any words. Look, yonder walks. No, we won't tell you any more. This one act of cruelty is sufficient. We told you purposely about this one incident because it shows us in what a devilish manner the Huguenots were killed. No one, whether old or young, was spared. That which happened in that night cannot be described with a pen. We shall spare you the rest, but the judge of heaven and earth knows what atrocities have been committed. His eyes run through the whole earth. His all-seeing eyes looked into the darkest murdering dens of France's capital. Charles IX, the king, stands upon the balcony of the royal palace. Unceasingly, he raises the gun to his shoulder. A bang, a piercing shriek, and below in the street someone else falls down, never to arise again. Like a maniac, the king shoots at his own subjects, who in mortal fear try to escape. One of the first ones who fell at the hands of murderers was the noble de Coligny. When the uproar broke loose, the aged man immediately scared awake. His wounds of the attempted murder upon him a few days ago were not yet healed. He listens closely for a moment as to what this means. He hears the kicking in of doors. He hears the screaming of deadly alarmed people. Immediately he realizes what is happening. "Friends," he says calmly to those who with frighted faces enter into his room, "friends, seek your safety in flight. I myself do not want to flee. I am prepared to die. I commend myself to God's mercy." A few indeed managed to escape. The majority of them, however, are overtaken by the murderers and killed. There the bitter enemies of the Grey Admiral already storm into his room. A youth, with a sword in the hand, walks ahead. "Are you de Coligny?" he asks the grey-haired one. "That I am," answers calmly de Coligny, while he looks seriously at him. "Young man, have respect for these grey hairs." As the only answer, he is pierced through with a sword. While dying, they fling him through the open window, where he plunges down upon the stones of the street, right before the legs of the horse upon which Henry de Guy is seated. Henry de Guy, his mortal enemy. He stood waiting in the street till they had murdered de Coligny. He had led his servants to the house and commanded them to cast the corpse of the Huguenot leader down because he wanted to convince himself personally that that arch-heretic was dead. Well then, his desire has been satisfied. There lies his enemy before him. dead and mutilated. And yet his unbridled hatred is not gratified. He cannot refrain from having the body of the Caligny trampled upon by his horse. After that, the corpse is dragged through the streets and is finally hung upon a gallows. The weapons of the Caligny are bound to the tails of the horses and dragged along. The castle of the Caligny is demolished, and the garden around it is turned into a wilderness. The killing is continued for days on a stretch, not only in Paris, but the lust for blood rages throughout entire France. How many Huguenots have been killed? God alone knows the exact number. Some writers estimate the number of slain to be more than 100,000. Others think that it was no more than 25,000, but no doubt they are those that want to mitigate that shameful deed. The exact number shall never become known. One day the books shall be opened, then the correct light shall fall upon this horrifying event. We just wrote that the king, as a maniac, stood shooting at the fleeing Huguenots. You may ask, perhaps, how is that possible? And was he not entirely under the influence of the Caligny? Yea, that was so, too. For a while it seemed as if his friendly association with the Caligny was in earnest. But that was a thorn in the eye of Catherine de' Medici. That wicked woman saw with increasing vexation that her son constantly began to feel more friendship for de Caligny. If that continued, then her devilish plan would fail altogether. For that reason, she had hired someone to get rid of de Caligny, and in that way to draw her son away from that influence. That murderous assault had failed. We told you this already, did we not? Then she decided not to wait any longer, but to take action because it became too dangerous for her. She made Charles IX believe that de Caligny had in mind to kill him and to overthrow the government. She slandered the noble de Caligny in the vilest manner. The king must become suspicious. At first, Charles IX refused positively to give his consent. However, he was compelled to submit. His mother reproached him for being a coward. Finally, he gave his consent. But, said he, then not only the leaders must fall, but then all the Huguenots must be exterminated, so that later not one of them shall be able to reproach me. Catherine de' Medici had triumphed. For that reason, in that terrible night, the king himself stood shooting at his innocent, defenseless subjects. He himself would help along to wipe them from the earth. How terrible, isn't that so? The lust for murder of the Roman Catholics raged even within the royal palace. The noble Huguenots who were feasting there were likewise killed. Only Henry of Navarre, the bridegroom and a cousin of the king, were spared. But they had to solemnly promise that they would become Roman Catholic. This terrible night is written down in history as the St. Bartholomew's Night, or the Massacre of St. Bartholomew Day, or Bloody Wedding. By this thousandfold murder, yea, 10,000-fold murder, France has raised up a pillar of shame unto itself, which can never be removed, that can never be made good again. Hastily, a messenger hurries to Rome to the Pope. He may bring that joyful tiding to the Holy Father, of that which has happened in Paris and in entire France? And does the Pope send him away indignantly? Does the Pope shudder at the thought of so much innocent shed blood? Does he disapprove of this massacre in the sternest terms? This we could really expect, isn't that so? Alas, the opposite is true. A cardinal gave 1,000 crowns as a reward to the messenger of this cheering tiding. Cannon shots were discharged from the papal palace. They were shots of joy. Everywhere the church bells were tolled as if it was a feast day. At various places, large bonfires were kindled. The Pope himself went with other clergymen in a solemn procession to church to thank God for his goodness and to sing the Te Deum. Did they celebrate in heaven too? In order that that memorable event should not be forgotten, a commemorative medal was issued in Rome. On the one side, the likeness of the Pope was impressed, while on the other side, a destroying angel was portrayed who descended upon the Huguenots. Around this was printed, "The Slaughter of the Huguenots." The Pope had even the courage to have murals painted in his palace. And what was painted on that? Jesus weeping about Jerusalem? Oh no, on that was represented the killing of defenseless women and children of the Huguenots. Is it not dreadful? And that man dared to call himself the Vicar of Christ. He would rule the Church of Christ well upon earth. The Holy Father also wrote a letter to the French King, Charles IX. Do you know what he wrote therein? Just read it. Continue bravely upon the way you have entered, and do not forfeit through a mixture of leniency that result which initially you have won through such a hard remedy. Thus, this was a papal approval. The Pope calls this a remedy. Rome uses strange remedies, don't you think so too? Besides, he exhorts the French monarch not to treat those that are left with leniency. Thus, that same remedy must be applied to all the Huguenots that were still alive. Really, from all this, it is clear that Rome celebrated. Also, congratulations were received from other Roman Catholic countries. When the tiding reached Spain, Madrid celebrated too. The Spanish king, Philip II, also wrote a letter to Charles IX. This monarch wrote that it was the nicest and best tiding which he had ever heard. In this letter is written, "I kiss your hand out of gratitude." A little further we can read, "Proceed in this way and cleanse your kingdom of the plague of heresy." Don't you see that the Roman Catholic Church took delight in this shameful massacre? In our days, Rome cast the blame from herself. But history speaks another language, a plain language. Let all those who want to side with Rome study history, and their mouth shall soon be stopped. Yet we hear other voices. The Emperor of Germany called it a disgraceful act, and in England the royal court put on mourning. There were other countries in which the murder of the Huguenots was spoken about with indignation. Naturally, nothing became now of the assistance which struggling Netherlands was to receive from the Huguenots in their war against Spain. This is self-evident, Isn't that so? That was a bitter disappointment for the Dutch people, who had already counted on that and had made their plans accordingly.